Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, this is your host, Lubna Munib. If you missed this podcast, I'm here to share with you an episode from another Kerning Cultures production, Al Empire. Al Empire features stories of exceptional Arabs around the world and their journey to the top. And in this episode, we sit down with adventurer Omar Samra to tell us about his exciting life journey. Omar went from being an investment banker to adventuring around the world, around its highest mountains, widest oceans, and the North and South Poles. And then he started his travel and adventure business. In this episode, we walk through his life's eccentric highs, literally, and mournful lows. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe to Al Empire on your favorite podcast app to receive new episodes every week. That's Al Empire, A-L-E-M-P-I-R-E.
I'm Dana Balut.
And I'm Hibe Fisher.
And you're listening to Al Empire.
I used to tell my father, you will see one day, I will make a film and I will go to Cannes. I didn't want to say that.
I felt insulted.
I was like, where is my audience?
I didn't go to therapy. I think I should.
This is Al Empire. Stories of exceptional Arabs around the world and their journey to the top. Today, we're speaking to the exceptional adventurer and entrepreneur, Omar Samra.
Okay, so what are all the impressive accomplishments that you've done? So you've summited the highest mountain on every continent. You have skied the North and South Poles.
To the North and South Poles.
I don't know. Are they not like, okay, yeah, you've skied to the North and the South Pole.
So there's two separate journeys, like skiing to the North Pole and skiing to the South Pole.
Okay. And then you are, you did the Atlantic row.
I attempted to row across the Atlantic Ocean. I rode about 1,000 kilometers with my teammate before capsizing in a massive storm, the boat not self-righting, the life raft not opening, and spending 13 hours not knowing whether we would live or die.
He says casually.
which has now actually been made into a movie. So that's really exciting.
Omar is the first Egyptian to climb Mount Everest. He's completed the 7 summits where he climbed the tallest mountains on each of the 7 continents. He skied to both the North and South Poles, rode across parts of the Atlantic, and has traveled to Antarctica, climbing mountains no other person has before. Omar started his own business, Wild Guanabana, out of Cairo in 2009. The company is a different kind of travel company that hosts adventure trips around the region and globally.
So I first heard about Omar Samra probably back in 2013. I actually met him at a co-working space here in Dubai. He was the first Arab adventurer that I had heard of. And that, as a chosen profession, is very unique, right? I mean, I know we used to be explorers, but today we're just, you know, we don't do this kind of stuff anymore. Right? Yeah. You don't scale mountains and you don't journey into the forests. And Omar has done all of that. And I wanted to know his story. Yeah?
Yeah, we're in English, right?
Yeah, yeah. So speak as...
So I met Omar on a weekday in February 2020, actually just after a huge rainstorm that had flooded all the streets of Cairo and thrown everybody's schedules off. Omar and I managed to meet, though, at a studio in Maadi in downtown Cairo.
Don't feel like you need to be amazingly articulate with a haga. And this is also super casual if you want to go to the bathroom, if you need to take a break. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah. My name is Omar Samra. I'm 41 years old. I'm Egyptian. I'm an entrepreneur and an adventurer.
And where were you born, Omar?
I was born in London, more specifically in Wimbledon. And I always say the story because I was born roughly at the same time the tournament was being played in Wimbledon, which meant that my parents thought I was going to be an amazing tennis player. That was a kind of like a prophecy of sorts, but I failed. I failed at tennis. At age 11, I found out why, because I was diagnosed with severe chest asthma. The doctor that my parents took me to said that, you know, Omar, you have a peculiar kind of asthma. It will disappear naturally in your 20s, but if you want to do something about it, you should start playing sports seriously. It was really, really bad. I would wake up every night, almost every night, unable to breathe properly and so on. And I took to the track, basically, and there was this one coach called Mohammad Rizq. He's probably changed my life. He probably doesn't even know it. He proceeded to train me, and then over the next sort of weeks and months, I got much more fit, and I stopped using a lot of the medicine and inhalers the doctors had prescribed. And that sort of started a sequence of events that led me to climb my first mountain at 16, and then sort of everything happened from there.
What took your parents to London?
My parents moved to London because my two elder sisters, we're a family of four. My two elder sisters are intellectually handicapped, special needs. And at the time, there was no awareness about that in Egypt. There was literally one government entity, but it was extremely under-equipped. So my mother felt really helpless. So the only thing that she could do is take my sisters abroad. And when I was born, they made the decision to move back to Egypt. And my mom made the decision to come back and do something about this problem that was there. And she started what was then the first organization. And that was how special needs awareness and education sort of started in earnest. And I always felt that I didn't want to be an additional burden. I remember this always being something that I thought about when a young age, that I wanted to be, you know, do well so that they wouldn't have to worry about me. I was a bit of a rebel in my own way, but my parents never got to know about those things because, you know, if you're good, you just never get caught, right?
What did you want to be when you grew up, and how did that manifest?
An astronaut, that's all I could remember, like maybe from the age of maybe 7 or something. I was really obsessed by it. I read a lot of science fiction. I read a lot of comics. Because I was introverted, very quiet, I used to play a lot by myself. So I used to, you know, with my little sort of action figures, used to create a lot of stories and a lot of scenarios, a lot of them, again, related to science fiction. That's something that stayed with me. You know, it's not a dream that I've managed to accomplish, but it's something that I've worked at for many, many years. In recent years, actually. And I'm still holding hope that it will happen one day.
What about your parents? What are they like?
I've, you know, taken a lot from my mother growing up. My mother was a very inspirational figure for me. The other thing is that I got from my dad is a very avid philatelist, a stamp collector.
What is that word?
Philatelist. Philately is the art of stamp collecting. My dad was so, bless his heart, he was so interested or so wanted me to get into stamp collecting so much that he, at one point, he made a collection for me in my name, and he entered it into a junior competition, and it won a bronze medal, not because of anything I did. And so, you know, as you do when you're growing up, putting in your CV, you've got nothing in there. I was like, well, you know, I mean, let's just put that, you know. And my biggest fear at the time when I was doing interviews was to be interviewed by a stamp collector, and then he would just sort of go deep into asking me about the collection. So I knew a few things so that I could ward off any suspicion. But if someone really knew his stuff, I would have been caught for sure.
That's amazing. Were you always adventurous when you were younger? Was there always this pull to nature, or did that come later?
I think, well, my first mountain experience was when I was 16. My parents gave me the opportunity to go to a camp in Switzerland, and there I picked one of the weekends you could pick from all the different activities, and I picked climbing a mountain. It was like mainly like hiking a mountain, and I got hooked on that. I remember getting to the summit, and even though I'd been to many summits after, that was one of the very few ones that was actually a little box, tin box, you know, under a bunch of rocks. inside it, there was a little notebook. And in that notebook, there was the names of everybody that summited this mountain. And I remember sort of looking through it. This was like a 16-year-old looking through it and seeing, you know, no name from Egypt, no name from anywhere close in terms of that part of the world. I remember being very excited about that. I'm writing my name, writing where I was from. And I took up the rest of the page and like drew a pyramid or something, just completely ruined the Swiss system. There was a lot of firsts during that camp. First kiss, first girlfriend, first mountain.
Climbing his first mountain wasn't love at first sight or anything like that. He enjoyed it, but he didn't immediately become an adventurer full-time at 16. Instead, Omar went your more typical route. He studied economics and business at the American University of Cairo, and upon graduating, he decided to move to London, where he worked as an investment banker at HSBC.
I wanted something different, and I wanted to set up a kind of life where I didn't know what was coming around the corner. And it seemed to me that staying in Egypt, I would be fitting a certain template. Those were the days when investment banking was actually sexy, like, you know, and where people actually earn money doing that. The first 2-3 months, just everything's so new, it was really cool. And then it started to get a bit like, what am I doing? What's this? I had a friend, his name was Dennis O'Connor. Every week, we'd go for lunch together. One time, at the end of lunch, he told me that he'd done this trip where he cycled from Nice to Naples. I was fascinated. This was like it was the coolest thing that I'd ever heard. And so I went to the bookstore. I remember like standing in front of the map section, closing my eyes and then just doing a sweep and just picking a map out, saying that whatever map I picked would be what I would cycle. And it was a map of Andalusia, which is the south of Spain. And then 3-4 months later, I was completely alone with a mountain bike, arriving in Sevilla in Spain, about to cycle around the south of Spain. I cycled for about 11 days. I felt so alive doing it. I remember like one moment when I had done this big climb, like big uphill climb. It was near Marbella or something like this. We started to hug the coast. Eventually we hit the coast, and it's a long, long, long downhill hugging the coast, and you can feel like the wind in your face. And I was just going down this downhill, not having to pedal. And then just all of a sudden, like this feeling of happiness just overwhelmed me to the point that I was laughing out loud. And it hit me that like I'm so happy, and I don't remember ever being as happy as I am now, but I'm completely on my own. No one else is responsible for this happiness. It's just me in the moment living this way. And I was like, I need to do more of this. This has to be my life somehow. When I came back to the bank, I still also remember very well the first time I entered into the office after this experience, and I felt like a huge like weight, like the weight of the place and the pressure and the whole kind of grayness of this kind of existence of like that I'm going to spend the rest of my life just sitting behind the desk, kind of plugging away. And that same week, I started putting together a plan of how I would exit the bank and this whole kind of world. It took me several years to be able to make it happen fully. And then I realized like, you know, 10 days or 2 weeks is not going to cut it. And so I started thinking like, if I wanted to travel for 6 months or a year, how much money would I need? And I started to create a budget for this, traveling obviously on a shoestring budget. And I had a figure, and that almost made the work more bearable, because I was like, I'm working towards this target. The last time I walked out of the headquarters building, knowing that I had just quit my job, not knowing what lied in front of me, was this feeling of lightness, you know? My parents obviously were not on board with this.
What did you tell them? Sahih, what did you... You called up your mom and your dad and you said, Mama, Baba, I'm going to bike around the world.
My parents took care of all my financial needs in school and everything like this up to the point of graduation. I had started earning money at this point. My dad was really proud of me. I'm sure my mother too, you know, like when they meet their friends, you know, oh, my son works in this big bank in London, this and that. And so he was coming to London. I was like, you know, I'm going to invite you for dinner. Like it was a really big thing for me. Like I'm going to invite my dad for dinner and this and that. And he was like, no, no. And I was like, no, no, I have to. This is like for me and stuff. And he was like, cool. And so I invited him for like a nice Italian like dinner, because I already made up my mind that I was going to quit. And I figured doing it over dessert is probably the best thing. So I waited until that was happening. And then I was like, I've decided I'm going to leave the bank. And he's like, oh, interesting. Like, you know, what other bank are you joining? And I was like, well, not really a bank. Well, I'm going to travel, and I'm going to travel for a while and stuff. And he couldn't, like, it was hard, because he couldn't understand, why can't you just take a holiday for 2-3 weeks? this was all very new to me, and I couldn't still find the words to articulate what it is that I was feeling. And so this is like one of the things I always tell people, is like, you don't have to be able to articulate what it is that you want to do, as long as you feel it, because the articulation of the thing comes after. I just had an insane feeling that this is what I need to do. And we paid the check. I paid the check, and we walked all the way to the train station. He was staying a little bit further out. The train was about to come, and so we had to kind of put an, you know, like, we had to cap this conversation. And he was like, "This is your life, you know, it's your decision and everything." But I don't think he had any doubt in his mind that I was going to regret this, like, in a very big way.
When we left off, Omar had just broken the news to his parents that after being a successful investment banker in London for the past few years, he was going to quit and instead travel the world.
What was the plan? The plan was to do what across all these places?
I traveled, I think it was about 13 or 14 countries across Asia and Latin America. I had a vague plan in mind. I had committed to a volunteer program in Central America, in Nicaragua and Costa Rica. So I knew I had to get there at that time. And I knew that I wanted to travel north from there, and I wanted to do the Trans-Siberian Railway, which goes two ways. Either you start in Beijing and you go all the way to Moscow via Mongolia, or there's another path that goes from Moscow to Vladivostok, so you just go across Russia.
How many bags did you take with you?
Just one. I'm very proud that I had like one hiking boot that I kept with me throughout the entire trip. Even though that when after I finished Nicaragua, it had a hole in the sole, because I ended up climbing a semi-active volcano thinking it was a mountain and getting almost to the top of the crater and seeing smoke coming out of the ground, and then looking and seeing that the soles of my boots were melting. And so I ran down. that trip was amazing. It was 370 days, I think 13 countries. I remember going to the Falls of Iguazu, which is this huge waterfall on the border of Brazil and Argentina. You know, looking at it, being like so overwhelmed with in awe of this, how magnificent it is and how huge it is, but kind of feeling like, yeah, you know, I've seen enough after like a couple of hours or something. And then it hit me like I've oversaturated myself with life. I've just been getting one experience after the other and haven't had time to really process what it is that I'm seeing, to the point that that's become the normal now. Like if I wake up and see an amazing like view or whatever, that's like just regular life for me. And so, no, that wasn't cool. Like I wanted to be able to go back and digest. And obviously, more practically, I'd run out of money.
That's when Omar decided to go to school for his MBA.
And I promised myself going into the MBA, and I was like, Omar, you've been really lucky. This is a chance for you to kind of really switch and get your career back in track and this and that. So you need to make a promise to yourself that for the next 2 years, it's just going to be like studying. And great. I'm super on board with that, like with myself. And then 3-4 weeks into the MBA, I get an email from one of the guys in the MBA. And he says, like, I've always had this dream of climbing Mount Everest, and I'm kind of looking for people to do it like after graduation. And I was like, what? I'm finding this opportunity in the most unlikely of places. I've just joined a top tier MBA program, and in the first month someone sends me that. So it felt like a kind of a sign. So I graduated, went on Everest. I was finishing my final paper, my group submission, in base camp. And then we went on the Everest expedition. That was about like 60 days or 65 days.
Omar Samra is the first Egyptian to summit Mount Everest. At the time, also the youngest Arab to do so.
I wanted to walk the same steps as Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. It was like as many of the big expeditions that I do, there was always some kind of romanticized notion of it. And so Everest, that for me, of course, the fact that it was like, you know, it's definitely not the hardest mountain in the world, but it's the tallest. And the fact that I had climbed that mountain in Switzerland, and I was sort of the first Egyptian on record anyway to do it, filled me with something. And I think that made me kind of think, like, if I was able to replicate that feeling but on the highest mountain in the world, that would be like even more spectacular. A lot of people recoil at experiences like this because there's a lot of hardship, and because, so what's the idea of, why would anybody want to go after, out of their own time, their own money, to do something so difficult physically and mentally and everything? But I didn't have that same relationship with pain and suffering and difficulty. Like, I've actually had a positive experience with it. It's through these challenges of like waking up every morning before school and like being pushed to my absolute limit every day with my coach that made me overcome my asthma and everything. So I had being put in adversity was not something, I didn't think about it as something bad.
And what did it feel like when you reached the top? So this is 2007, you were 28 years old. Can you put me in the moment of when you actually reached the peak?
So it was the 17th of May of 2007. It was extremely labored, like your movements at that time. So usually you take a step and you take 4 or 5 breaths before you take another step because of the lack of oxygen. In the morning when I was finally making the final steps to reach the top of Everest, because the whole journey sort of leading up to this kind of like going through my head, sort of like almost like a reel of film passing by really quickly, I get like within like 3 steps from the summit. You know, it's been 12 years since I first dreamt up this idea. I've been training for 2 years specifically, like 2 months on the mountain. I get 2-3 steps away from the summit and I realized that I forgot to ask the most important question of all, which is basically like, who am I going to call when I reach the summit? And I know what people are thinking, like when I say that, and probably like that doesn't sound very important at all, but if you're Egyptian, you'll understand that if you call the wrong person from the summit, you're just never going to hear the end of it. Every time you meet with your family and, you know, a person's going to be like, why did you call him and you didn't call me? And I'm like, it has to be my brother because, you know, he's one of the closest people to me, if not the closest. So I take out the satellite phone. In those days, you use the satellite phone from the top of Everest. Now you can use China Mobile. It's basically like, it's like minus 30, 40 degrees, high wind speeds. I call my brother. He doesn't pick up the phone. And so I'm like, okay, this is not how I imagined it, but, you know, it's fine. He's maybe in the bathroom or something. So I'm just going to count to 10. So I go like 1-1,000, 2-1,000. I call him. He doesn't pick up the phone. So I call my mom. She picks up the phone, I think, before it even rang. And I speak to her and she passed the phone on to my brother. I spoke to him and I don't remember anything that I said, but I do remember very well what they said to me. And the first thing was, we're very proud of you. And the second thing my mother said, like, what on earth are you doing on the summit this long? Get down. And it was funny to receive, you know, climbing advice from my mom, but she was right. I thought I was on the summit for about 15 minutes. It was probably more about 50 and it was getting dangerous. When you get to the summit, there's a handful of people up on the top and literally you and those like very, very few people are the highest people on this planet at this moment in time. So it's amazing. And then you realize that you're only halfway and you have to get down and then that kind of kills it a bit. But, you know, you celebrate on the top, but the real celebration happens when you get back to safety.
After Omar climbed Mount Everest and graduated from the London Business School in the same summer, he decided to return to Egypt. He continued his career in finance, working with some friends at a local firm, and decided to start a travel company. So then you come back, you're working with your friends in private equity, and then did you start Wild? I don't know how Guanabana. To say the name of your company. How do you say it?
Guanabana.
Guanabana? What is that?
It's a fruit from Latin America.
What is it?
It looks like ishta. It's like a big, almost oval-shaped, green, spiky fruit. And when you cut it open with a machete, it looks white on the inside with black pits.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Okay,
you also call it soursop.
So you started this. You started Wild Guanabana, your travel company, in 2009. Can you tell me? So this, you take people on trips internationally, and then also in Egypt, these adventure trips. Can you talk to me a bit about why you started the company, and is there a mission behind it that you're trying to do?
I always had this nagging feeling that there was something else out there that was more right for me. And I felt that I owed myself to try. My idea was that I wanted to do something that married my passion for adventure and business. But the main thing was that I wanted to do something that helped reconnect people with nature.
Wild Guanabana hosts adventures for people to go on in Egypt and around the world. Since it started in 2009, the company has hosted over 200 trips to something like 25 countries.
And I wanted to create a vehicle where people could live these experiences in a way that was, meaningful, authentic, ethical, and run professionally and so on. Travel at its best is a positive force for change for the local community or the host community. Travel at its worst disempowers these local communities, and the money stays in the hands of a few people in the big companies, and it doesn't trickle down.
When did you decide I'm going to do the Explorers Grand Slam, which is to summit the tallest 7 mountains in the world, Everest being one of them?
So I embarked on that in 2008 after I climbed Everest and started over a number of years, 6 years, to climb all 7.
It's something called the Explorers Grand Slam, which is this adventure challenge to reach the North Pole, the South Pole, and the highest mountain peaks of each of the 7 continents. As I list them now, forgive me for butchering some of these names, but here are the mountains that Omar has climbed. Mount Everest, Mount Kilimanjaro, Denali in Alaska, Aconcagua in Argentina, Vincent Massif in Antarctica, Mount Elbrus in Russia, and the Karstens Pyramid in Indonesia. It's obviously insanely hard to climb all of these. Only 67 people in the world have ever achieved this, and Omar is the first Egyptian to have done it. Shout out to another Arab adventurer, Maxime Shaya from Lebanon, who also completed the Explorers Grand Slam, actually a few years before Omar. But anyway, back to Omar's Grand Slam.
The bigger challenge was actually securing the funding for it. So a lot of parts financed by sponsors, which is obviously a challenge, and it's why a lot of my plans sometimes get delayed. I find over time it becomes easier and easier to secure sponsorship because I've built a name for myself and a track record.
When you think of these really difficult, far-flung places and you're going to put yourself through 2 months of, of hardship, are you being driven by the adrenaline of it? Are you being driven by how beautiful the place is going to be when you're there? What is driving you to keep going back?
Like, I'm driven definitely by a sense of beauty and aesthetics of the places that I go to. I'm also driven by the sense of peace and calm that I find there that I don't find like anywhere else, and also a sense of clarity. Like, I have insane clarity of mind when I'm in these places doing these things, and most of my life's biggest decisions have come to me, including like quitting my job at least one of the times while I was out there. Not every moment in any expedition like this is like that, but there are moments when you're climbing up there and the scenery is stunning and the sun is just rising and everything just like almost like time stops and everything becomes so perfect. Your mind is so clear, like all of a sudden you have this flurry of emotions and it's like heartwarming, and you've just had this brilliant idea or this thing that you've just been stuck with and achieved clarity of mind, and you know exactly what you need to do, and your life there is like so simple and it's removed from the complexities of regular life. There isn't all the noise around it. To me, there's no adrenaline at all in anything that I do. To me, adrenaline is always linked to things, doing things fast. You know, base jumpers, skydivers, these people, like, there's a lot of adrenaline. When they have to make split-second decisions, I don't enjoy these things at all. Like, with the kind of endeavors and pursuits that I do, it's like things actually happen really slowly. You're hiking, you're climbing, you're rowing an ocean, like, nothing's happening fast. It's about being patient. It's a bit more of a journey, and it seems to me far more spiritual. It also feels to me like a very noble pursuit. It's a pursuit of human endeavor to prove to yourself, to prove to other people that you can do these things. When people give metaphors about challenges and stuff like that, it's always akin to mountains, climbing a mountain, reaching the summit, when you achieve success. And a mountain journey is exactly like that. You actually live through, it's like life compressed.
So Omar has climbed Everest, he's done the Explorer's Grand Slam, and in a two-person kayak, he journeyed across the Atlantic Ocean, nearly dying in the process. He's done on-Earth lunar missions, where he's camped out in isolation for 2 weeks in Poland for lunar research. And he tells me space exploration is what's next for him. Do you find day-to-day life boring? Like city life, do you find day-to-day city life boring?
I don't find day-to-day life boring, city life boring. I find day-to-day life without an aim like to work towards a little bit hard to manage. It's something that I struggle with because the ups and downs of my life have been so extreme. like, you know, from the ups of, like, you know, reaching the summits of these mountains or completing these projects to the ultimate downs, which would be the loss of my wife.
Can we talk about Marwa?
Yeah, of course.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Can you tell me how you met?
Marwa and I actually met because of my job, because of a wild guanabana. How I met Marwa was interesting. It was in 2010. I started a company in 2009, and I started promoting for a trip to Kilimanjaro, where we would climb and also use the opportunity to raise awareness and funds for special needs in Egypt. And Marwa's half-sister, special needs, and so she kind of gravitated towards that, and she saw an advertisement about my company in GMAG, which is this tiny little magazine that, because it's so small, it's a great bathroom read. I think she was reading it while she was on the toilet. And she reached out, and I remember the first time we spoke on the phone, I was in Sahel, I remember, and we were on the phone for over an hour.
And you guys spoke for an hour? What did you talk about?
Yeah, I remember
that
we spoke for, because in Egypt, when you cross the hour, the phone hangs up automatically. I think it's just it's like foolproof, like in case you've left the phone. And so I remember, like, we calling each other again to continue to finish the conversation. We talked about a lot of things. It was one of those conversations where I didn't, like, you know, I didn't really feel that I was talking to a stranger. And we were like, we became really good friends on the mountain, and then, like, more after that. I ended up proposing to Marwa, like, very, very soon after, like, we met. I proposed to her on the 4th of April. She said yes, and then I told her that I had one more thing to ask her that day. And I told her that I suggest that we get married on the 5th of May, which is literally, like, a month and a day after. And it's because she had this habit of, first of all, I didn't want to get engaged because I already knew that I wanted to marry her, and I thought it was pointless. But she had this habit of, like, grabbing my notebook and, like, in odd days of the year, just scribbling, like, just random notes, sometimes like smelly boogers or like things like that. But and that specific day she had written, this is going to be an amazing day. So I thought it would be really cool to have that day, that she had actually picked the day, but, like, unwittingly picked the day. Everything happened really fast. Everything just happened so effortlessly, and it felt like our life was really perfect, but at the same time, like, so effortless. We were together as a married couple for 2 years, but I think those 2 years could probably be most couples, like, 5-6 years. We literally were in each other's company every second of the day. And I climbed the seven summits, and the last one of the seven summits was the mountain in Alaska, in Denali. And so I came back to Miami because she wanted to give birth there, and it was in those, like, 2 weeks that I spent in Miami that just everything just, you know, I was literally on top of the world when I climbed the seven summits. I'd climbed the highest mountain on every continent, but I also felt like, you know, I just accomplished my life's biggest achievement and all of this. And then within 2 weeks, everything just unraveled, and I found myself in the intensive care unit, like, with her on the bed, with the doctors, like, trying to resuscitate her. And it was just like watching a really, like, a movie, but I was the protagonist. And then eventually, like, they kept saying, you know, that we will keep trying, and I remember that I kept sort of, like, begging them to keep trying more. And then it was very mechanical. I just, you know, one of the doctors just said, you know, time of death, and just recorded. They left me, they were like, we'll give you some time. And it was just, you know, she's just there, and it was like, I spent those final minutes basically trying to tell her everything that I thought I had, like, a whole lifetime to say, and it was very difficult. At the time, I didn't even know, like, we had agreed that we would call my daughter Tila, but everybody in my family was against it, and her family. And then I decided that, so I just kept talking to her, and I walked out. I remember walking out of the intensive care unit just like a kind of a shell of a human being. I just went through, like, a very, very dark, like, dark period. When this life event happened with Marwa, it was very clear to me that this was the most important, like, life event that has ever happened to me. And it almost seemed that my entire life, all these expeditions, all these adventures, all this kind of, you know, honing kind of my mind, trying to grow as a person, achieving more clarity, having more self-awareness, has almost, all of these things have been just preparing me for this one event. And it's hard when you go through something like this to not succumb to the overwhelming idea that, like, my life is over and I don't care what becomes of me anymore. You're just completely alienated as a person from yourself. So you just want to do something for the person who passed. And that becomes your driving force until you're able to become kind of a human again. I remember that she had this initiative that she did where she used to collect used toys and for orphans, and she would collect them from friends and family, and then she would go to the orphanage and spend time with the kids and play. So I wanted to resuscitate this kind of idea. We managed to register it as a charity, and now 6-something years later, we've delivered over 100,000 toys in 10 countries. Makes me feel good to know that, like, you know, she's potentially looking down or seeing all this and happy with what we've done.
And can you describe to me Tila? What is she like? Your 6-year-old daughter.
Tila is amazing. She's like the best of Marwa and me. She has fortunately more of Marwa than me. Her and I have like a very special bond and are very close. And I think she's going to grow up to be like a really great person. She's named after a cartoon character. And Tila was a character that was a sorcerer and a warrior. I like the idea of naming people, naming things in such a way that they grow into the names. And I think, like, for a Egyptian woman growing in kind of in those times, to have elements of magic, which is basically believing that there's much more to life than what you can feel and touch, but also being a warrior. She has a really, really, really amazing sense of humor for somebody her age especially. The best thing about her is that she's extremely considerate, extremely sweet, which means that she also gives the best hugs ever, even when she was very, very little, like very little arms and small body, but she hugs you and you feel that someone like bigger than you is embracing you. The third time I went to Antarctica, I attempted to climb a mountain that had never been climbed before. And I ended up climbing with a guy from Alaska. In 2 weeks climbing 7 mountains, 3 of them had never been climbed before. And so when we got back to camp, we were told that we could name those mountains.
What did you name them?
So those mountains are really 3 really beautiful mountains in Antarctica, standing side by side. And so I named one Mount Samra after my family name. The second one was Mount Marwa after my late wife. And the third one was Mount Tila after my daughter. It was very poetic for me because the 3 mountains were stand side by side in Antarctica, which to me is, you know, the most beautiful, least affected continent on Earth from human kind of stuff. And so for me, it was like, it's kind of a tribute. Whatever happens, those 3 mountains will remain together. And then, you know, at the end of it, if my daughter, she knows that there's a mountain named after in Antarctica, but she's only 6, so I think she thinks that everybody has a mountain named after them. And when she grows up, maybe she'll want to go climb it, or at the very least, it will be an interesting story she can tell in a bar or something.
This episode was produced by Tamara Rasamni, Alex Atak, Hiba Fisher, and myself, Dana Balut. Sound design by Tamara Rasamni and mixing by Mohamed Khreizat. Fact-checking by Zena Duwaydar. Our original sting was composed by Ramzi Bashur, and El Empire is produced by the Kerning Cultures Network. Rode across parts of the Atlantic and has traveled to Antarctica. Antarctica.
Vincent Massif in Dana, this is so hard. Yeah, that okay.
If you're liking An Empire, please subscribe to the show so you'll never miss an episode. Also, leave us a rating and a review on whatever podcast app you're listening to us from. Be honest, but also give us a little love. It really helps boost our ranking so that other listeners can find us on the podcast libraries. Thanks for listening, guys. Take care.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.